Well, welcome everybody. This is It Could Be Said. I'm Will Cording. I'm joined as always by the one, the only, Dr. Luke Middup. Say hello, Luke.
Hello, Will.
Well, this has been a week where Brexit has reared its ugly head. As we have talked about, I think, a couple of times, the big plan is to return to the issue of Brexit when we have the election out of the way. But it's got to be said that there's only one thing anyone's talking about this week, and that is Brexit. And why is that, Luke?
Well, Theresa May decided to get up outside Downing Street and set her hair on fire. I've certainly got to hand it to her. She is no longer boring.
She basically stood outside Downing Street and went to the entirety of the European Union, come on if you think you're hard enough. It was the most extraordinary statement I think I've ever seen a Prime Minister give. That desperation one, Cameron gave when he knew he was losing the EU referendum. Well, the point is, Theresa May is at least 15 points ahead in the polls, so it's quite remarkable. To recap what she said, she talked about European politicians making threats against Britain to influence general election results. I quote, "This shows how tough the Brexit talks will be. Britain's negotiating position in Europe has been misrepresented in continental press. The European Commission's negotiating stance has hardened. Threats against Britain have been issued by European politicians and officials. All of these acts have been deliberately timed to affect the result of the general election that will take place on 8 June. And she goes on to say, "The events of the last few days have shown that whatever our wishes and however reasonable the positions of Europe's other leaders, there are some in Brussels who do not want these talks to succeed, who do not want Britain to prosper." Wow. I mean, wow.
Jean-Claude Juncker, I'm looking at you.
So yeah, before we get too much into the weeds about why we're surprised she said this and how unusual this is, let's explain why she said it. Over the weekend, a very curious thing happened. There was an English person in Germany who could read German. And no, it wasn't our good friend Hamish Stewart. It was Jeremy Cliff, a reporter for The Economist. And he read a German paper. Didn't have to get translated or anything. It was really impressive. And it was basically a blow-by-blow leak of the dinner that Juncker and some of his senior aides had with Theresa May, had with David Davis, as a kind of get-to-know-you, confidence-building exercise before the Brexit talks start. And this, you know, leaked all sorts of embarrassing things. It leaked things about David Davis making some bad jokes about when he had used European Court of Justice to take Theresa May to task over civil liberties, about how Juncker thought that Theresa May was on a different galaxy, that Theresa May was silly to want a quick deal on the rights of EU citizens. And that Juncker actually, and the key one is that Juncker went to Angela Merkel the next day at 7:30 a.m., if you believe that, and basically told Angela Merkel, "These guys are idiots, they don't know what they're doing." And then Angela Merkel went and gave a nasty speech on a Friday explaining why the British are idiots and they need to realise that there's a price to Brexit. What did you make of the leak and some people's reaction to the leak?
Well, I mean, I think for a start, it wasn't designed to influence the British election per se. I think it was designed to influence the German election. Nobody tries to influence a British election by leaking to a German newspaper. I think Juncker's purpose, and let's be clear, it is Jean-Claude Juncker that's leaked this. I can't remember which journalist said it, but this leak is quite unusual in that we know exactly who it's come from, because there were only four people in the room: Theresa May, David Davis, Jean-Claude Juncker, and his chief of staff, Martin Selmayr. And obviously May and Davis have no interest in leaking this, so it's come from Juncker or his chief of staff. And I think, by the way, that's one of the reasons why Theresa May has taken such a strong stand. Normally with leaks, it's very difficult to tell where they've come from. But that's not the case this time.
Yeah, this is one where it's almost so blatant, it's insulting. It's like, not only are we leaking this, but we're leaking in full knowledge that you know we will leak it. I mean, there's a theory about it being about influencing the German election. Stephen Bush of New Statesman said it's probably a way of Angela Merkel getting her excuses in early, basically trying to explain this may go badly, don't expect the deal with the Brits, they be cray-cray. I also wonder whether there's a bit of the internal European jockeying for power, because it is striking that one of the key things you take from this is that Juncker has a close working relationship with Merkel, that the reason why she did that big speech that got a lot of positive coverage in the European institutions, particularly the Parliament, was because Juncker had asked her to do it. And one of the key winning subplots of the next 2 years will be the extent to which the Commission, so, I mean, we in Britain usually call it the civil service. That's not really accurate. It's not a civil service in the way we in Britain would understand it, kind of a technocratic, non-partisan body of administrators. But the Commission is basically the permanent bureaucracy of the European Union. But you then have the European Council, which only recently got its own president, and that's Donald Tusk. The Council tends to be less federalist than the Commission. You also have the European Parliament, which is the most federalist of them all, and that's democratically elected MEPs. And so who of these is leading negotiations, and to what extent they have to appease European Parliament, which will be kept as far away as possible, is going to be one of these subplots that we keep going to. And I wonder whether Juncker was just trying to say, look how good I am, I ran rings around the Brits, I then got Merkel to do something for me, I'm in charge. Are you having to think about that?
Well, I mean, I think there are two interesting things there. One is that the EU's chief negotiator, a former French foreign minister called Michel Barnier, apologies to Simon for my poor French pronunciation, laid out his vision of the negotiating process on the same day, on the day after this dinner took place, on the same day as the leak. And his tone was very different from that leak. I mean, we'll talk about the particulars of this in a minute, but he was much more conciliatory, and what he did was lay out quite a clear process. Now, it's important to understand he is the European Council's man, not the Commission's. So I think you're right there. I also think
just one thing at that point. Just one thing at that point. So it wasn't just his vision. So it's actually part of the Article 50 process. What he outlined was the mandate. So the brilliant fudge that the European Union came up with is that the Council will have the lead negotiator. The Council will outline the mandate for the negotiations. And that is kind of like what the EU is trying to achieve. But the chief negotiator will be supported at all steps by the Commission. And so like the chief negotiator's office will be staffed by the Commission, which is why I say, you know, the possibility of political intrigue is just built into that process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I also think it's interesting that Donald Tusk today, in a series of tweets, I think rebuked both May and Juncker, and, you know, said, look, guys, you know, you made your point, let's take the temperature down, let's be adults, you know, we're not going to get anywhere name-calling. And I think people have taken that as a rebuke to Theresa May, and I think it is, but I think if you read it carefully, it's also a rebuke to Jean-Claude Juncker as well.
One of the striking things, and this is one of the things where the speech was so extraordinary, is it seemed like the government had decided to take it on the chin. You know, David Davis had just talked about it as being kind of like chaff. It was just normal, the normal type of thing you get. Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, had similarly dismissed it as waffle. And it also looked like the Europeans had realised they may have gone a bit far. I honestly believe they didn't think we'd find out. They're like, when Juncker was leaking this, it was like, you know, won't this annoy the Brits if they find out? And it's like, do you seriously think there's going to be a British person in Frankfurt that can read German? They're like, nah, probably not. It will be fine. We'll be fine. and their master plan was foiled. In terms of people looking at this comment as a rebuke to May and not Juncker, that was one of the annoying things about the leak. You had a lot of Remainers just jumping on it and saying, oh my God, look at how stupid Theresa May and David Davis are. And it's like, well, They're kind of stupid, you know, they're conservative politicians, whatever. But, you know, Juncker is an alcoholic prime minister or a tax haven. He's not exactly a paragon of virtue himself. So why you'd assume that something that he has leaked on his behalf is the gospel truth? When all the signs before this leak were actually that the talks were getting on fairly smoothly, there'd been nice exchange of letters, the comments on accounts have been fairly warm, it's slightly mystifying. And if Remainers keep jumping on everything the EU says, treating like gospel, they're going to thoroughly alienate not just leavers, but any genuine moderates who are torn which way to vote. Because if you keep almost gleefully picking your country's rival, your country's opponent, people are going to start to say, well, actually, whose side are you on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be an issue further down the line. What I think is interesting about this whole story is that it's another example of the Commission in particular assuming that because it has a better technical grasp of EU law and the EU processes, that somehow means they're more politically savvy. And these two things don't necessarily equate.
What everything you have to bear in mind is Juncker is just a deeply inadequate figure for this historic moment. Again, I can see the argument that sows may. But, you know, he was just a former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, and he wasn't a particularly distinguished Prime Minister of Luxembourg. It's only because of this DAF system where the two major European parties get to nominate somebody, and they nominated the most federalist member of the European People's Party. And then David Cameron completely botched the attempts to stop him getting the job, that he's ended up in this pivotal role. You know, there's literally, I mean, it's kind of like the old days of Berlusconi. There have literally been videos of him swaying at European conferences, getting a tad too friendly with some of the leaders before photo calls. I think one of the things that really made things worse was the splash the FT had, Financial Times had, on the Brexit bill. Because I think the leak story had started to die down. Now, the government had kind of gone out there and said, oh, it's nothing, don't worry about it. You know, that's not the way we recollect the meal. And then the FT had this big splash that said that actually the Brexit bill is even higher than was originally thought, because the Germans don't want us to have a share of EU assets. The French and the Poles want us to keep paying into agricultural subsidies. And they might be as much as 110 billion euros net. And I think that was what made me. Because it almost felt a bit like we turned the cheek on the leak. But now this has came. If we turn the cheek on this, what's going to come next day, the week after? We almost have to draw a line in the sand. And maybe not what I'd have done, but I can fully sympathise with why she felt she had to do that, particularly when you think about how, you know, the Clinton campaign turned the cheek over all the Russian interference. And look where that got them.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've got to be careful not to take that parallel too far. I mean, in fairness to, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker, what he did was perfectly public and above board. It's not the same as planting stories through WikiLeaks or hacking websites. So I wouldn't take the Clinton.
No, I wouldn't make a direct comparison. What I'm saying is, I wonder if we ignore these small stories, it might snowball into something bigger, or it might come a drip drip that makes us less popular. And you say that, I mean, the leak, no, it is fairly unusual for a multilateral dinner like this to leak in that detail. I can't think.
Well, I mean, let's face it, Will, it's fairly unusual to be having meetings of that consequence this close to a general election.
Well, that's true, and there's an argument that was maybe a mistake on May's part. And again, with the leaking of the story about a Brexit bill, that's unusual. That is unusual to do stuff like that. So yeah, it's not espionage, it's not this or that. But still, it's not what's normally done between friendly partners. You know, there is a self-denying ordinance.
Hang on, Luke.
Let me finish. There's a self-denying ordinance that during elections, EU leaders will go out of their way not to do anything that might embarrass the neighbouring governments. So yeah, I'm not comparing what they did to the Russians. But that doesn't make it right. I mean, and Theresa May may be thinking, if we let this go now, we might not get the chance to stop it before it hurts us.
No, but we have to acknowledge we're not a fellow EU government anymore. We're not in the club anymore.
But we are still in the EU club.
We are to some extent now a rival to the European Union and a threat to it. And we're going to have to get used to that fact.
Well, yes, but in that case, then
because they may not want to punish us for Brexit, but if Brexit is seen as being too successful, you're going to set a precedent for states like the Netherlands, Sweden, possibly France at some point in the future. So,
I think that fear is overblown. I think we left for very idiosyncratic reasons and. Because of that, it'll be more than possible for us to think we've succeeded, and the rest of Europe to look at us and think, God, what are these idiots doing? And like Euro, I mean, Euro, we've been successful outside the Euro, but it's not as if anyone's queuing up to leave the Euro. Quite a reverse.
No, but I've got to come back on that, Will. Yes, we left for our own idiosyncratic reasons that are our own. But if you talk to a Dutch person, if you talk to a Swede, if you talk to a Dane, they will have their own idiosyncratic reasons for wanting to leave the EU. And Brexit may look different to other states leaving the EU, but I don't think you certainly can't say that profound Euroscepticism is a British thing.
I can, actually.
Well, you can, but I
just... Scotland, the most pro-European part of the UK... still had 39% of Scotland vote to leave the EU. Maybe France for its own reasons, but other than France, I really struggle to think you'd find a country that would go 39% to leave the European Union. I just think we are different.
Well, I can name you three: Holland, Sweden, Denmark.
No,
actually, Czech Republic as well.
I really don't think they'd vote in those numbers to leave. I really, really don't.
I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree because we're going to get bogged in.
I think the key thing is that everyone's meant to be friendly. We are still part of the club. We're trying to get the best possible deal. We're trying to...
We're not still part of the club.
Luke, we are still part of the club. We are still paying our dues. We are still bound by our responsibilities. We've not left yet.
Yeah, but we've told them we're going to leave. I mean, the whole point of this negotiation is over what terms do we leave. We can't pretend... we're negotiating our exit while still being part of the team. That's ridiculous.
But we are part of the team, Luke. We are. Luke, are we paying into the budget?
Yeah, but in a...
we haven't followed the laws?
Yeah, but we're talking about politics.
Luke, don't talk about... Are we even
followed the... We're talking about technocratic...
These are technocratic details, Luke. We are part of the club until we leave. In the same way...
We're negotiating the terms of our exit. We can't be part of the club whilst planning to leave. That's ridiculous.
But we're negotiating. We are negotiating to leave. Therefore, we have not left. If you have not left, you're still there. We're still part of the club.
Well, no, I think it's interesting we as Brexiteers are having this argument. But I think you've got to come to terms with the fact the EU is not our friend anymore. Well, we are a hostile power to them now.
Look, to me, the reality of the situation is, if that is the way they see it, this is going to go badly wrong for both sides, and maybe that is the way they see it. But that will be a no-deal Brexit, because you won't be able to survive on 2 years of antagonism and get Britain to even accept a good deal. It will be so bitter and rancorous. And I feel someone like Donald Tusk. He knows what's at stake for like his own Poland and other Eastern European countries. They don't see us as an enemy. They want to try and bind us in as much as possible. I think
enemy may be a bit strong, but rival certainly. And this is the point: any deal that's going to stick has got to be based on mutual interest, not mutual goodwill.
But you won't be able to recognise mutual interest if you don't have mutual goodwill. If we really think see each other as rivals, then it doesn't matter. You won't do mutual goodwill. You'll want to stuff over the other side. I mean, this is the whole reason why May had to quickly repair the damage over the Donald Trump visit. Because a lot of the Europeans were very concerned about was the idea that Britain would see itself as a rival to the European Union, would try and destabilise the European Union from the outside, would almost like...
Which, by the way, I think we should do.
Well, if we have to, but it'd be better for us just to leave and let the European Union do what it does. I don't think it helps us to get into an antagonistic relationship.
We're
still defending all of Eastern. We're all still defending Eastern Europe. We are moving
You've got to draw the distinction between Russia. Europe, the geography, and Europe and the European Union.
Why are we moving those things? That is because we're still sticking to EU-led sanctions against Russia. If we were really being antagonistic to the European Union, we'd be cutting a deal with Putin.
I mean, personally, I mean, this isn't for another podcast, because I think we've agreed to do this at some point later. But to me, the whole idea of trying to strike a deal with the European Union is quixotic. We should just leave.
Yeah, let's leave that for another time. I mean, one thing I would say, and let's go back to my deal thing. I mean, one of the things I've been worried about this week, in terms of whether we can get a deal done or not, is the attitude to the Brexit bill that we're talking about in the FT. And the issue you're getting... So, like, people talk about the Brexit bill, and everyone seems to think now it's a punishment. And it's not a punishment. It's basically saying, look, guys... We thought you were going to pay for all this stuff, and we've gone ahead and ordered it. Is it okay if you just pay your share? And, you know, what our share is, how long it's reasonable to ask us to keep paying, these are reasonable points for debate. But the idea that we can't just get up, leave the table, and refuse to pay for anything everyone's ordered whilst thinking we were going to help pay... doesn't really seem fair. There are a few other bits and pieces, but the lion's share of the money is basically things we would have had to pay for if we stayed in the European Union. Things like, you know, development projects in poor European countries, farm subsidies, all this sort of stuff. It's not about punishing us. It's just about saying if we're going to have a gradual unwinding of our relationship, you need to keep paying for some of this stuff. And I think what's happening is you're getting a bit of a toxic thing because the government keeps trying to downplay this. The leavers outside the government keep saying you shouldn't pay a penny. And the remainers are saying, ha ha ha, we were right, the EU is making you pay lots of money. Well done, Brexit. And if this keeps going for 2 years, it doesn't matter whether it's 100 billion euros or 20 billion euros. No government will be able to pay it because the idea...
I think what we've got to establish is, yes, we should pay something. But on the other hand, we're under no legal obligation to do so. If we pay something, it will be because we've struck a political deal of which that's part. Why I think the government is saying that. And the House of Lords Brexit Select Committee looks into this in exhaustive detail. And the House of Lords isn't exactly a body that's pro-Brexit on the whole. And they concluded that legally speaking, we don't owe the EU a dime.
No,
when we leave, we leave. And I think that's why you've got David Davis saying, I think they want the, I think May and Davis want to establish that this is not a legal obligation, this is a political agreement.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, but I think they need to, I think they need to be a bit clearer with the people. And I think, and I think the language of, you know, kind of similar to what they're saying about EU citizens, that, you know, of course we don't want to leave the European Union in the lurch. Of course we realise European Union has started projects, assuming we'd help fund. We want to be in a position on basis of friendly relations where we keep paying for these projects to either reach a natural conclusion or for a reasonable period of time. But as the European Union says, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And I think that's probably what's going to happen, that you're probably going to get a situation where the sketches of the formula to work out the bill are agreed and what's in and what's out. But then we have the rest of the negotiations, and at the end it's like, okay, if we're all happy, this is what you owe us.
Well, it depends. If we're paying this money, what are we getting in exchange for it?
Well, that's why I said it's like, if, you know, you agree the formula, so this is the things you're going to pay for. You then have the rest of the negotiations, and then you come back to it and say, are we all happy? Yes, we like the deal we've struck. Okay, here's what you owe us. Now, if at that point we say we're not happy with the deal, and we're so unhappy we refuse to pay that, then the talks break down and we leave on WTO terms. So I'm sure that's what will happen. But I think the government has prepared people for the fact that, you know, we are probably going to end up spending 40, 50 billion euros, but it's no big deal because it's money we'd have spent anyway. You know, don't think of the money you'll spend in the first 10 years. Think of the money you'll save in the next 20.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's true. But, I mean, I'd be quite happy to pay something, because I do think we have a moral obligation not to just walk out on people. But the idea that would be anything close to 110 billion euros is for the birds.
No, and to be fair, if you actually look at the detail, even the FT wasn't saying it'd be 110 billion euros, because what that included was loans to other countries that the EU has made. So it'd be like, you need to make this portion of a loan that we promised to make over the next few years, but you'll get it back. So even the FT, and this is like the maximum...
Well, that's not...
The maximum biggest Brexit would be that actually, ultimately, it would be like 55 billion euros. Because what would happen is we'd make these loans with the European Union, but then we would get our share back, you know, and at the same time they were paying the European Union back, they'd also be paying us back.
I mean, it would also be important to establish, are we paying this in euros or are we paying it in pounds?
Paid in euros, which is one of the other things, because this bill, I mean, this is one of the arguments, actually, where we may want to agree a figure. If the Europeans, which they wouldn't, if the Europeans would let us settle the figure now in pounds, may not be the worst thing in the world to strike an early deal. Because if sterling does continue to depreciate, you'll keep getting the bill go up and up when you're calculating how much the government has to pay in pounds. I mean, it's quite funny, actually, and this will make Remainers throw up in their mouths. It makes me throw up in a bit of my mouth as well. But all the British MEPs have got a pay rise because mm-hmm. they get paid in euros. So, like Nigel Farage and Daniel Hannan, not only achieved the ideological dream, but their pay went up. No good.
Well, why wouldn't we want to no stay in the glorious organisation such as this? Can you tell, listeners, can you tell we both voted leave? just asking.
I'm sure we can be friends. Maybe. And I'm talking about us and the EU, not me and Luke. We are friends.
Yeah, although at some point me and you are going to have this out.
You'll watch the world burn type Brexit. So, it's, as we are on the elections podcast, it's worth talking about the likely impact of the speech on the election. So, the Prime Minister's speech after Downing Street this most reminded me of was Tony Blair when the attempt to get a second resolution of the Iraq, for the Iraq War in 2003 failed. And he basically went out and said, it's not my fault, it's those mean French people, you know, cheese-eating surrender monkeys, who refused to back me in my idiotic war. But we all must unite, because otherwise the French will win. And you know what, Luke?
We did. And
yeah,
they did.
It worked. We united.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think electorally this speech was a no-brainer for me. I mean, forget bashing the French. Bashing any type of foreigner works in a British election. What I found really remarkable about the speech is not so much the content or the tone, it's where it was delivered. That was delivered on the steps of Downing Street. This wasn't delivered on the hustings somewhere in some backwater constituency. This was delivered in the heart of government. I mean...
Yeah, but it's okay because the seal wasn't on.
It really is extraordinary. And for somebody who I'd been complaining that they'd been boring and somewhat timid, this was a massive turn up for the books.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with Theresa May. She's not timid, actually. She's not cautious. She just takes her time. She's very much like, you know, big bomb, long fuse. I mean, yes, it will play well. Xenophobia does work in British elections. It places at the forefront the idea of prime ministerial leadership. It places at the forefront strength. Doesn't quite seem the most stable thing for British Prime Minister to do, but it's only puts strength in the mind.
Well, I mean, going back to the substance of this for a second, I don't think it's a bad idea to establish at the beginning of these negotiations that there is a certain amount of nonsense up with which we will not put.
What was it they keep doing it?
Sorry?
What was it they keep doing it?
Well, to put this politely, they can stick their trade deal up their bum.
What's amazing is that you were the swing voter. I decided to vote for Brexit far earlier than you did. You've been radicalised over the past year.
I just think if you vote to leave an organisation, trying to say, right guys, we're leaving, but on the other hand, can you cut us some deals? Just doesn't work. If you vote to leave, you leave. And then you come back and try and cut deals as a third party. But this half in, half out, we're leaving but we haven't really left kind of thing, just seems to me to be the ideal breeding ground for antagonism and failure.
Well, I would agree on trying to stay in the single market, because the big secret about Brexit is that Brexit doesn't mean Brexit. Brexit means reducing immigration. That's what Vote Leave campaigned on, that's what the people voted for. Even the NHS pledge wasn't really about the NHS, it was about we want to stop spending money on foreigners, let's spend on ourselves instead. I'm not talking about every Leave voter, like, but both me and you had our own idiosyncratic reasons for voting Leave, but I think the broad mass of people, the opinion polls, focus groups, showed that's why they were voting for Brexit. And that's what Theresa May, in all fairness, got. And that's why she's made reduced immigration the key pledge of these negotiations, or taking control of the immigration system. So we can't stay in the single market. There are ways to stitch together some sort of relationship. You know, there's no reason things like Euratom or Europol or have to be part of the core EU matrix. Likewise, there's already precedent for countries not part of the European Union, not part of EEA, to be part of the customs union. But that's for negotiation. One thing I would say is striking that pretty much, you know, you talk to journalists, pretty much all of them say canvassers from all parties are reporting that Theresa May's line of, you know, It doesn't matter if you're Tory, I just need you to lend me your vote so I have a strong negotiating hand in Brussels, really is working. That people do...
It's working because nobody, not even the Labour Party, wants Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister.
No, I think it's working more, I think even more than that. It is working at the level of people say, if our Prime Minister is stronger in Parliament and they know she can't be, she won't be removed, she will be a more impressive figure on the national, on the international stage. And it's funny, a lot of Remain journalists kind of poo-poo this idea and go, you know, the EU does not care how big Theresa May's majority is. Which is a very odd line for people who want to stay in the EU. The EU does not care about our democracy. It does not care how British people vote. Every British politician just looks the same to these people. It's an odd... That's the type of thing I would say. You know, it's like the EU doesn't care about Britain. It doesn't care what we think. It just does what it wants. So this schizophrenia of the Remainers, where the EU loves and respects us, it doesn't care how we vote. It's a bit odd.
It is a bit odd. Anybody that claims that the EU isn't interested in domestic elections, speak to somebody in Greece, speak to somebody in Italy.
Or speak to somebody in France, where Helmut Kohl and the CDU had a great big secret bank account to help bankroll their allies in France. Allegedly.
We're not supposed to know.
The best example actually of how closely they follow is that the statements from European officials actually have the shrewdest point, which is their majority. I mean, I think the size of the majority is important because I think trying to do these negotiations with majority of 20-ish, you do run the risk of the strain getting to a point where the government implodes and a coalition of Remainers formed from moderate Tories and a bulk of the Labour Party and the Lib Dems. Tory majority of 150 just makes that impossible.
Yeah.
But what shows you how closely the European Union follows this is more than one official has said it will be good to start these negotiations with a government in for 5 years, because it now means rather than that you can have your 2-year Brexit negotiation and you could potentially have transitional arrangements for 3 years and still finish it before the government next needs to go to the people. So it actually should make Brexit easier, providing you get a strong government that is also stable. But in terms of how it influences the elections, this has got to be good.
It's got to be good for me.
What about Labour? What impact does it make on Labour?
Well, I don't know about you, Will, because I've actually, disclaimer time here, listeners, I've been travelling quite a bit in the last 24 hours, so I'm perhaps a little bit behind the news here, but I haven't seen much in the way of a formal Labour response. Have you?
The formal response was, oh no, not Brexit again. We were talking about spending money on things for the past week, and it was popular. We like spending money on things. Don't make us talk about Brexit. You know we're divided from top to bottom on immigration and can't make our minds up because everybody in the Labour Party has one of two completely different positions on this key topic. That was the Labour Party's response. They basically just ran away.
And the Lib Dems' response was, we agree with the European Union until people start shouting at us.
Well, but the problem with the Liberal Democrats is, their great gambit of the Party of Remain may well be the most sensible way to rebuild their relevance, but it probably needed more time because they needed to actually build infrastructure in some of the new seats they were going to try and take in metropolitan areas. The snap election means they're fighting the old They basically are a fight where they used to be strong, which unfortunately includes the most Eurosceptic parts of the UK. Matthew Goodwin had a very good article about the Tories' blue wall in the southwest, Cornwall and Devon, and it's just like, you know, the Lib Dems are screwed here. There's a couple of seats they might pick up, you know, that are a bit more cosmopolitan than the rest. But other than that, they don't stand a chance in hell. And the reason is, a lot of these seats are Eurosceptic. Even the Lib Dems used to be Eurosceptic. But also, they all have quite sizable UKIP votes. And one thing we can all be sure of is UKIP is done as a major party. I mean, this is going to be a slaughter on quite a biblical level when it comes to the election.
Because it would be, except they don't have any MPs.
Well, in terms of votes, in terms of government, they did get 13-14%. So, you know, this could be, I mean, I suppose it can't really compare to the Lib Dems, where they lost about 19-18%. But these guys really may see their support halved. I mean, actually, they'd probably do well to escape with it only being halved. Because one of the things you're finding is, one of the things that helped UKIP under David Cameron is so many Tories left the Tory party, actually primarily of unhappiness about gay marriage, if you actually look back. Gay marriage caused the Tories to lose loads of activists to UKIP. But they're all going back. I mean, I remember reading journalists on Twitter saying, you know, I've got a list of numbers of key UKIP contacts in key constituencies. Every single one, it's either gone back to the Tories, or I've been suspended, or I don't do politics anymore. You know, they are imploding at a local level. But even if they weren't, when you have the Tory Prime Minister go out and tell Europe to do what, why vote UKIP? What does UKIP do that the Tories won't now?
I mean, I think Douglas Carswell, the lone UKIP MEP that quit, made the point quite well. Standing on a UKIP platform in this election makes about as much sense as standing on an anti-corn law league platform. You know, the job's done.
Well, it's an interesting comparison, because the thing that poor wee Douglas Carswell, sorry Miles, the problem with poor wee Douglas Carswell,
hello to Gillian Duffy by the way,
is he can never quite grasp he joined the Protectionist Party, and to be fair, neither did Nigel Farage. I mean, well, Nigel Farage was willing to sell his free trade principles out for national relevance. There clearly is a role for UKIP in British politics. You know, there's plenty of mileage in a Pujarist type appeal where, you know, you're going to go against the big multinationals, against the have a real hard line on mass immigration.
Can't we just explain for our non-French-obsessed listeners what a Pujardist is?
So it was a precursor to the National Front. It was a movement in the 50s, that was basically, I can't remember the best way, but it's basically, imagine small shopkeepers, your small farmer. It was kind of like the little man movement. I mean, there's a famous de Gaulle quote, and it was like, in my day, shopkeepers voted for lawyers, now lawyers vote for shopkeepers. It was very much that thing of imagine, I suppose in Britain actually the best thing would be white van man in a modern sense. You imagine a movement that, well, it wasn't working class, it was a bit above that, it was upper working class, lower middle class. And the Tea Party is probably a good example. The American Tea Party?
Yeah.
Not perfect, but the American Tea Party is kind of, it's people are affluent in distressed areas. And they basically were anti-immigration, anti-welfare state, anti-big business, anti-cosmopolitan. And I think there is a role for UKIP to be that party, because there's no way the Tories will ever go that far. The problem is that with the European Parliament about to lose, our participation in the European Parliament about to end, and with nobody with the superstar quality of Nigel Farage, they don't have anybody who can lead. And, as we said as well, they don't have the message discipline to become that sort of party. There are too many libertarians, there are too many old school Tories.
Mm-hmm.
The thing's just imploded, because the only thing that kept this rather odd, disparate group of people together was campaigning to leave the EU.
Yep, I agree with all of that.
And ironically, the ability to claim money off the EU as well.
Yeah, I agree with that as well.
It's interesting. I got into an argument again with Miles about when we talk about the Progressive Alliance. You know, should someone like Caroline Lucas have just gone into the Labour Party? And I do believe, you know, maybe she has some really extreme beliefs that she's hiding, and that's why she couldn't join the Labour Party. But everything I hear from Caroline Lucas, it's like, you could advocate for that in the Labour Party. I don't understand why you didn't just become a Labour MP, and then maybe with a good gust of wind, you could have became the Shadow Environment the Environment Secretary, and actually implemented some of these policies. Maybe you could have even become the leader of the Labour Party. And to be fair to Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, they got this. And it's not just that they got it after the left lost ascendancy. They got it when they joined the Labour Party. They didn't join one of the Trotskyist or Trotskyite or Leninist micro parties on the hard left. They were like, no, you got to be where the action is. The action is the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Try and take the Labour Party over, because parties are malleable. If you look at how the Labour Party and Tory Party since the Second World War have bounced around on different issues, the idea that you just have to accept, you have to like decide whether to join a party or not because it suits exactly your beliefs at the time you want to join it, is wrong.
I kind of half agree with you and half agree with Miles. I agree with you in the specific case of Caroline Lucas, but as Miles pointed out, there are more than three distinct, coherent political philosophies that it's possible to defend. And, for example, I don't think Nigel Farage would have ever fitted very comfortably in the Conservative Party, because while he might agree with people like Douglas Carswell or Dominic Raab on Europe, they were never going to agree to his views on multiculturalism or his rather inchoate view or the fact that he wants to privatise the NHS.
But this is the thing, isn't it? It's like I can point to Tories have all those views. I mean, Carswell is actually unusual in being quite liberal and being a Eurosceptic. Most of the hardcore Eurosceptics are very sceptical of multiculturalism. Farage easily could have fitted in with the Tory Party. He might have been a different Farage because he wouldn't have been able to march to his own drum. But I have no doubt Farage could have. The one thing I did say is that UKIP
I think you just hit the nail on the head. He wouldn't have been able to march to his own drum. And there are going to be significant groups of people out there that aren't going to want to make the kind of compromises you're talking about. They are going to want to march to tune of their own drum.
But that isn't coherent ideology. That's just petty vanity. That's just, I'd rather be able to say whatever I want and actually make a difference. Now, again, there is an exception with Farage. That Farage is very lucky that he had decided to join UKIP. At the same time that the European Parliament was being changed from being first past the post, like Westminster, to being PR. And I think people really do struggle to understand just how strong UKIP have been in the European Parliament. I mean, you have to go back to 2004 for when the Lib Dems had more MEPs than UKIP and got more votes at the European parliamentary elections than UKIP. You know, UKIP have been a force. Like a real force, not just say, oh, well, they got a couple of seats. Like a significant presence in the European Parliament since 2004. In 2004, they got 12 MEPs. I think now they have, about 20, between 25 and 30?
21, I think.
Did those, that low? big delegation.
Well, there are only 70 UK MEPs.
Yeah, we're saying it's still. I'm sure that I think they've got like 28. Can you look at it on my talk? Because I'm sure it's more than that.
I'm talking as well.
Yeah, I mean, what were elected? Because I've lost a lot of MEPs due to scandals. The reason why I said, can you look for it, is if I look for it, it will hurt the recording. But anyway, they've got a lot of MEPs. And that means they have a lot of people with the status quo by question time. They have a lot of people that are paid to be full-time politicians. They have a lot of people that can claim office expenses and have paid staff members running around and doing things for them and the party. That's just going to go away. And so I think when people talk about UKIP and look at how successful UKIP have been and look at the difference they've made, then that's true of UKIP. But you won't be able to replicate that until we get PR.
24, by the way.
24. Until we get PR, there are two parties in Britain. There are the Tories, there are Labour. Yes, in Scotland, there's the Scots Nats. But even there, you see the two-party system re-emerging, where you have a centre-left party and a centre-right party between the SNP and the Tories. Any MPs within Northern Ireland, which basically just will trade votes for money, or are effectively Labour MPs in the case of the SDLP, any other MPs, effectively an independent, and would get far more achieved if they work within one of the major parties, because each major party is malleable enough that if you know what you want to do and you can argue for it, you will get far if you're good enough. There's no reason. Douglas Carswell was plenty well before he got into UKIP. He was plenty recognised as a Tory backbench MP. Because
I disagree with you, Will. Let's use a historical example here. Probably the best historical example. Enoch Powell, a man of very idiosyncratic views, whatever else you say about it, his combination of views was entirely his own. Now, he could never succeed in winning a constituency for those views that translated into political power because he was stuck in a party and he didn't fit it. He would have been much better off sitting as an independent MP.
No.
In fact, he was when he sat for the Unionists.
Yeah, but that's because he was wrong. If he'd have kept his mouth shut in 74, and he would have lost the second 74 election, he'd have became leader of the Tory party. His views weren't incoherent. They were proto-Thatcherism.
No. There was proto-Thatcherism in there. But they were much more. I mean, his anti-Americanism wouldn't have washed in a Tory party. Neither would his extreme free market ideology. I mean, Thatcherism was always much more of a compromise than people remember it being. But the point is, I think the point we're circling around is here: is do you get into politics to get on, or do you get into politics to make a point?
Yeah, but
I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. But I think you and Miles are both right and both wrong, depending on where you start from.
But no, I think I disagree, because the thing is, Enoch Powell could deal with that. What you're saying is Enoch Powell could never become Prime Minister because his views were too unpopular to be elected Tory leader. But he would have... No, it is very easy to imagine a situation when Enoch Powell becomes Tory leader. Very easy. But the other point, though, is because we have a two-party system, because we have first-past-the-post, even if he didn't join a Tory party, even if he did form his own party and somehow managed to get elected, he still couldn't become Prime Minister because he'd be a micro-party.
He'd have been better off in a micro-party because he could have allowed him to be Enoch Powell.
Was he Enoch Powell, Luke? What could he not do? What could he not do before he left in 1974? I mean, he didn't even need to leave in 1974. What he should have done was declare himself an independent for that election, say vote Labour everywhere else, then rejoin the Tories. But, you know, he managed to do everything he wanted to do as a Tory. He was able to completely shaft Ted Heath and completely against Ted Heath's and Willie Whitelaw's immigration policy, not just in terms of we should restrict immigration now, but actually talking about sending people back to their country of origin. Far, and this is what people always forget with Enoch Powell, far and away, no, it really is, it's probably a more extreme immigration policy than even a National Front today in France. He was able to be a complete menace to Ted Heath when Ted Heath got into government. He was able to ridicule his chancellor. He was able to lead the rebellion against the European Economic Communities Act. He could do everything he wanted. This is a great thing about being about the British system.
Yes.
If you get elected and you just want to be a backbencher.
But you're missing a larger point, which is he did all of that. And what was his reward? To be called a Judas.
But Luke, this doesn't make any sense. All a micro party can be is a backbench MP. They can't be a government minister. They can't form a government of their own. So.
Yeah, but this is my point. This is my point. There are some people in politics for whom that simply does not matter.
No, but you're not listening, Luke. Because you've said this before. Luke, you're not listening, Luke. You're saying, okay, it doesn't matter. They don't want to be a government minister. And I'm saying that's fine. Be a backbench MP. Be an extreme Tory. Be an extreme Labour. You don't need to join. You don't need to start up a micro party to have that platform.
George Galloway gets no more
attention as a Labour MP or as a respected MP because he's George Galloway. People want to listen to him.
Well, if that's true, UKIP, the Greens, the BNP, the Liberal Party, Plaid Cymru, the SNP, none of these should exist.
Well,
Because by the logic of what you're saying, you can put all those views into one of two parties and it just doesn't matter.
Well, here's what I'm saying, right? UKIP were a special issue because we had PR. So my thing is, if you have PR, you no longer have big catch-all parties and the parties divide. And then you probably get a hard left party, Corbyn, McDonald party.
No, hang on. When Alan Sked, and now we're really getting into the weeds, but when Alan Sked set up UKIP, he wasn't thinking, oh, there's a hole here that we can, there's a set of SDV elections we can exploit here. He did it because his beliefs didn't fit comfortably into the existing party structure.
Well, he left quite soon after, and to be fair, his beliefs probably don't fit in quite with the existing party structure because he's a lunatic. My point is you change the parties. Pick the party close. And again, UKIP is an exception. The reason UKIP did so well was because of the European Parliament. That is why it had such a big impact. The Scottish Nationalists are an exception because they want to leave the country.
You're coming up with all these exceptions, Will. It's not much of a rule.
If you can get a group of people, more than 10, then it's worth doing. So if you can dominate a region, then it's worth doing. So if it's like you want to represent Scotland, and you say the British parties will never listen to Scotland. Yeah, that's fine. Plaid Cymru, there are all sorts of historic reasons why Plaid Cymru exists, linked to the Welsh language. I think they actually do struggle to justify why they exist, as is shown by the repeated coalitions with Labour, and the fact that they haven't managed to achieve the success of the SNP, despite Wales being more inhospitable to Tories for much of its history. Yeah, the Liberals are kind of like the appendix of British politics. You know, they exist because they were once the major party. They kind of fulfill a role of being the anti-Tory party, the anti-Labour party in Labour constituencies, the anti-Tory party in Tory seats. But to me, ideally, if you're going to have fast past the post, you do have something more like America, where you have generally open primaries, where, you know, you have your Labour Party, you have your Tory Party, and they have their primaries. And if the centre-right people in that constituency want to go in a different tack, they just pick a new MP. And that's how you get new ideas. And to be fair, I'd have PR. I would have all these different smaller parties. But if you're going to have first past the post, the way you get to actually achieve change is to be in one of the major parties. UKIP is an exception because they had the benefit of the European Parliament. The SNP will only achieve change through their domination of the Scottish Parliament. Even at 50 MPs, there's not much they can do in Westminster. You only achieve change by being a Tory party or the Labour party. You may not like it. I don't like it. As I said, I'd have PR, but that is the system we have. And I think, you know, talking about people like Enoch Powell or Caroline Lucas, Douglas Carswell, just proves the point, because they either did this stuff in a major party before flouncing out, or they could do it if they wanted to. And well, you can say, oh, they don't care about being ministers. But join a micro party want to make a ministers either. They could just do this as backbench MPs. And in the current parliament, the benefit of being a backbench MP as well is you might just get a select committee chairmanship where you could actually drive the agenda on your issue of choice.
Well, I think we've got it there, because otherwise people will be getting a bit antsy. But I think that's been an interesting podcast this week. Well, certainly an impassioned one.
This is a mistake we made. We didn't do a proper running order like usual, and I didn't tire Luke out by making him research a load of individual constituencies, and so you had a bit more fire in your belly. You were swinging for the fences like Vladimir Klitschko against Anthony Joshua.
And on that note, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Talk to you later. And as always, make sure to catch us out on halfguarded.com. And if you could, yes, I'm going to say it, if you could rate us on iTunes or we treat the podcast, that'd be greatly appreciated. Talk to you in a while.